Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 57 for July 6, 2010. My name is David O'Brien and I'll be introducing our panelists this week. With me I've got
Dominic Ribey
and Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, we have three stories this week. First one involves a company called Research 2000 and a lawsuit involving the accuracy of their polling methods. Our second story is all about the iPhone 4 and its antenna problems and a potential class action which has been followed. Actually, I think several class actions. And finally, our last story involves the Dell Computer Company and another lawsuit involving them and broken computers. Ben, why don't you take our first story away?
So as David mentioned, this first story is about a company called Research 2000. Research 2000 is a polling company started by a guy named Del Ali. He was a former employee at other polling companies and one day decided to start his own and kind of started out from scratch and worked his way up to this company. Now, there's another website that's involved called Daily Kos, which is a left-leaning blog. And Daily Kos commissioned Research 2000 to conduct a series of weekly tracking polls over the course of, I think it was about 2 years. Now, what happened is Daily Kos published not only the pure results of the tracking polls, things like president's favorability and Congress's favorability and favorable unfavorables for the party leadership. They also published the breakdowns for party affiliation of the people who were polled and for the male-female splits for the people who were polled. And they published this again for almost 2 years. Eventually, Nate Silver of 538.com, who's an extraordinarily good statistician and has done some great work in the field recently, ran these numbers and ran numbers of all the major polling agencies and ranked them based on how much error they introduce into the polls above what you would normally expect in a polling condition, and found that Research 2000 was at pretty much the bottom of the pack. As a result of that, Daily Kos sacked Research 2000 and said, "We don't want your services anymore because you're clearly not that good at polling." And this sparked a few other statisticians to kind of dig down and look closer at the data that Research 2000 had been putting out over the past few years. And they found some very obvious markers that Research 2000's data was falsified. For starters, when you would look at the favorable unfavorables, both of the numbers, so it would usually be something like 38% think favorably of, let's say the majority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, and so 38 think favorably and 44 think unfavorably. And that means a whole bunch were undecided. But what was curious was that every single time the first number was even, the second number was even, and every time the first number was odd, the second number was odd, which is something that you wouldn't expect in a poll. It should be a pretty much toss-up as to whether or not they're both even or odd. And it turned out that the chances of, this coincidence happening, that both of the numbers be even or both of the numbers be odd, was astronomical. It was, 10 to the 228th against, which is just an absurdly rare coincidence. And another big error that they noticed was that Research 2000 very rarely had the president's favorable unfavorables week to week have no change. And what you would expect here is that there'd be a bunch of weeks where there's no change, fewer weeks where there's plus one or minus one, and then even fewer weeks where there's plus two or minus two, and kind of making a nice bell curve. But the Research 2000 data had essentially what was a bimodal curve, where plus one and negative one were very high, zero was almost nothing, and then it started trailing off again as you got to the plus or minus twos and beyond. Now, as a result of this, and the reason why we're talking about it here, again, sorry for the long-winded introduction, is because after this information was published, Research 2000 came back and sent a series of cease and desist letters to both the Daily Kos, to the people who conducted this research, and to Nate Silver at 538.com. Now, Dominic, just,
yes,
from a first blush, What kind of claim does Research 2000 have against these people who are publishing? What kind of claims were they asserting, or do they actually have? Let's start with that.
I'd imagine some sort of defamation, because if what they're saying is untrue, then this is significantly harmful to their business.
Right, but if it is true, so I guess my biggest problem with this is Research 2000 has not come out. They basically said we've conducted all the polls that we were asked to conduct. They haven't, at least in the statements that I've seen, said anything about these charges being false, about them not having doctored the numbers at all. So,
Right.
taking
Their
that
defense
as
so
true.
far, yeah, their defense so far is that they have changed the numbers, but it's within the parameters of what they feel they can do to make the numbers look good.
Right, and Research 2000 has also said the guy at the head of Research 2000 has said that basically all of his clients have abandoned him already. So what damage has been done has already been done. You gotta wonder, what point there is of sending a cease and desist out at this point in time. The most interesting cease and desist, though, and the one that I think I'd want to talk about for a little bit of time, is the one that he sent to Nate Silver at 538. So Nate Silver has done nothing other than publish this ranking of pollsters, for which he put out all the information as to how he calculated this ranking. And then he posted some news stories about this very legitimate news story. So could people be sued for, putting somebody too low on the rankings of the 50 sexiest women?
They can
How is that
certainly be
actionable?
sued, but they're probably not going to win. There's a lot of latitude given for that sort of thing. I mean, the action.
Specifically,
Or go ahead.
we're talking about whether or not the statements that were made on 538 were purely factual statements, and that being that 538 was factually saying that these polls were absolutely wrong, versus more of an opinion, which is more like, well, if you run the statistics on what the poll results are showing, it looks like there might be some statistical anomalies there. So you've got kind of two baseline inquiries. You have a question of whether or not there are in fact statistical anomalies as a factual matter, and whether or not the 538.com posting is saying something that's incorrect about those numbers. And then let's say that it is incorrect what they're saying. You might have some latitude whether or not that's just an opinion-based thing or whether it's a factual-based thing. And those sort of underlie the claims of defamation there.
Yeah, some of these cease and desist letters were posted, and I remember reading them and being starkly impressed by the fact that there was no allegation that anything that was posted was false. All they said was, these postings substantially hurt our reputation and we'd like you to take them down. There was no allegation that they were libelous or anything, which I think is very unusual for a cease and desist.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty true here. I mean, I'm looking at the cease and desist letter right now, and it basically one sentence in here reads that such comments have the effect of damaging the company's reputation and the company's existing and prospective business relationships. And then it goes on to say, at the same time, you failed to acknowledge or recognize the contractual obligations that Daily Kos has with R2K. Pursuant to this letter, we demand that you cease and desist all such activity negative to Mr. Ali and the company. So, like you just mentioned, Ben, I mean, this seems to go more directly to the point that what is being alleged here is not so much that 538 is posting something that might not be factually correct. It's more that they're upset that this has interfered with some of the contractual relations that they might have with some of their clientele, in addition to the Daily Kos.
And I don't buy that interference with business relationships argument at all. For the most part, if you want to make a case that somebody has interfered with a business relationship or an existing contract, you need to prove that the person has knowledge of that contract or knowledge of the prospective business relationship. And I don't know. I mean, this is obviously going to be pretty fact specific, but I'd be very surprised if
Right.
Daily Kos had any specific knowledge of Research 2000's contracts with other parties.
And I think in some jurisdictions, I don't know if this is true in all of them, you actually need like an intent to interfere with the contractual relationships. So you don't just have to know about them, but you have to want to disrupt them. And that doesn't really seem to be the point, at least just looking at the face of the 538 posting that, you know, the poster was intending to do. It wasn't like he intended to disrupt those the clients and the relationships between them and Research 2000. It was more about pointing out the factual inconsistencies or the statistical inconsistencies of the poll that Research 2000 had conducted.
Dominic, any other broad thoughts on this? I mean, this is obviously something that's of some deal of concern. We don't want people going around faking data, but I mean, what really bugs me about this is that his response, Research 2000's response, was no. Well, we are messing with the data, but we're messing with it within the realms of reasonability. That unless that was in a contract somewhere that he's allowed to fudge the data, that doesn't strike me as something that's reasonable for pollsters to do.
Well, I mean, even if it's something that is contractually fine, I agree it's not something that's reasonable for pollsters to do. You don't just change the numbers to make them look good, and having someone else point it out and then turning around and saying suing that person for it, I don't think they should win that lawsuit just because, I mean, it's perfectly fine pointing out that this guy's tweaking his numbers this way, and his reaction is kind of strange, because if he doesn't feel anything's wrong with it, why is he so defensive about it? And at the same time, if he does think something's wrong about it, well, why is he doing it?
Yeah, what's the point of a cease and desist to say stop talking about this if you don't think what you're doing is wrong?
Right.
That being said, the flip side of that is if, you know, why do people claim the fifth if they haven't done anything wrong? But, you know, there are big differences between a criminal case and a civil case here.
Right. He doesn't need to send the cease and desist, whereas on the stand someone might just not trust their nerves. It's a completely different situation.
David, any last thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it kind of comes down to what was in the contract between the Daily Kos and Research 2000, because, like you mentioned, there might have been some provisions in that contract, if there was in fact a contract, that allowed some latitude for Research 2000 to kind of manipulate the numbers beyond just the pure math. And that's your basic factual issue there. You know, as I go through the cease and desist letter, on the second page, they have basically set this up so that they can make two claims after the cease and desist letter. And that includes filing claims for unfair business practices, which is pretty similar to contractual interference with a third-party relationship. And also, they mention in here trade libel and interference with the company's business relationships. And it looks here that they are indicating that they might file those lawsuits in either the state of Maryland or in the District of Columbia. So, not being familiar with either of those two jurisdictions, you know, they've set themselves up to make claims here, but there's some real factual problems, it seems, with what they're saying. I mean, it's apparent that the 538 guys saw some sort of statistical anomaly and felt the need to point it out, and just to note that this was not accurate, as they saw it, an accurate polling. That said, it seems that any kind of claim that you make with regard to defamation or trade libel is going to be very difficult to prove. And based on my understanding of interfering with third-party contractual relationships, those two would be pretty hard to make. And finally, as just a quick final point, there's also a possibility that Research 2000 could get in trouble for fraud. You know, what they might be claiming is an accurate polling might not actually be an accurate polling, as the 538 post pointed out, and that could subject them not only to an additional civil lawsuit between Research 2000 and their client, the Daily Kos, but also possibly criminal actions in the jurisdictions with wherever Daily Kos resides, or the state of Maryland or the District of Columbia, too.
Yeah, that is something that we didn't mention. Daily Kos did threaten lawsuits for fraud and breach of contract. And the Research 2000's response to those suits wasn't, we didn't commit fraud or we didn't breach our contract. It's that this is really a billing dispute because they owe us $70,000 in unpaid bills. And one more quick note on that. Daily Kos's response to the unpaid bills part was, we paid for every poll we ordered, which makes it sound like Research 2000 was doing extra polls without being asked to do them and then billing Daily Kos for them. which Daily Coast would have absolutely no burden to pay for. But yeah, it's an interesting story. And I think
Yeah.
with that, I'll wrap up,
Well,
unless Dominic
one.
has any, or David.
Yeah, just something really quick. And it's always difficult to speculate on our end what has actually gone on between these private parties because we don't have the contracts in front of us and we might not know all of the facts. So there might be some additional facts that help out this case one way or another. You know, for instance, if 538 was aware of some of the relationships and there actually was some sort of intent to disrupt, you know, other relationships with the clients, that would certainly go in the other direction. But we're, as always, we're sort of running off of limited information here.
And on that note, I'll take us away to our next story, which involves the iPhone 4 reception issues and another lawsuit, this time a class action lawsuit, filed against Apple on behalf of all iPhone 4 users experiencing this issue. You may have heard of this, and if not, here's a really quick summary. Apparently, if you hold the iPhone 4 a certain way, specifically blocking the left corner with your thumb so as to complete the circuit somewhat, it will sometimes, on some phones, send the signal down to zero and drop your connection. Steve Jobs has been emailed about this, and people have said, and he just says, don't hold it that way. Apple also offers a $29 plastic bumper, which will eliminate the issue by just putting plastic between your hand and the phone. Nonetheless, the law firm Kershaw, Cutter and Ratnoff has filed a class action complaint against Apple and AT&T. They say on their website that they have over 1,250 people who have responded to their inquiry, and the vast majority of them agree that they have issues. But to me, that kind of makes sense in that if you're looking for people, do you have any problems with your iPhone? If you do, come say you do. Well, it's going to be a little bit of selection bias there. In any case, the particular claims they're filing against Apple and AT&T are general negligence, breach of implied warranty for merchantability, breach of implied warranty for fitness for a particular purchase, deceptive trade practices, intentional misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation, and fraud by concealment, because they allege that Apple and AT&T were aware of these reception issues and concealed them from the public before launching the phone, and now after 1.7 million people bought the iPhone 4 on release day, and the other people bought it later on as well, they came forth that, hey, we might have some issues, and the software update supposedly is going to fix it, but that remains to be seen and hasn't even come forth yet. And they're also suing Apple for defect in design, manufacture, and assembly, as well as breach of express warranty. Esteemed panel, what are your thoughts on this particular case?
Well, first of all, there. Sorry, Ben. First of all, there. This isn't the only suit that has apparently been filed. I'm reading on Ars Technica right now that there are a number of lawsuits that were filed. It looks like there might actually be five lawsuits, maybe two of which are class actions, including this one. And then there's been some other filings from individuals against Apple for the same issue.
Is there a merit in such an issue a week after a phone, in such a lawsuit a week after a phone has come out? Let's take the hypothetical that Apple indeed was aware of these issues, figured, well, you know what, if we tell people about them, we'll probably depress sales of the phone, plus it doesn't affect every phone, and I mean, you can just not hold the phone that way, so we're just gonna launch it as is. Would say that that is the case, that Apple knew about it ahead of time and went ahead and launched it. Is there still hope of recovery in that best case scenario?
Maybe. I mean, that's really the best answer that I can give right now. So, one of the things that we should mention is that these suits were filed in various, these class action suits were filed in various states throughout throughout the union, and each of those states has slightly different law with regard to all of those different claims that Dominic mentioned. And secondly, this is going to be a pretty there's I mean, first you have to get the class certified, and then you actually have to get to some sort of resolution on all of these things. My guess is before that happens, either Apple will come to some sort of class settlement. I can't see them taking this thing all the way through, or they'll try to get summary judgment on at least the class certification. So, yeah, the first thing is whether or not the class actually becomes a class action, and whether or not all those people are actually joined in the suit. But with things like general negligence, I don't really see how. I mean, it's a tough call. for me. I mean, because I'm looking at one complaint here where they're asserting general negligence and defect in design, manufacture, and assembly. For general negligence, it's kind of subsumed with the design defect, unless you're trying to assert some sort of strict liability for the design defect. But if you're doing strict liability, my recollection is that in a strict liability case, there can't just be economic damages. There actually has to be some sort of physical damage. So, you know, if your toaster explodes, you can't just recover for the cost of the, you know, toaster. You have to have some physical damage to go along with the economic damage. Does that strike anyone as correct?
Sure. And I guess it's worth noting that, you know, sometimes what happens in when any lawsuit gets filed is that when you're in the position of a plaintiff's attorney, it's just best to make as many claims as you can against the other party, and sort of take the spaghetti out of the pot, throw it to the wall, and see what sticks eventually as you get up to the motion to dismiss stage, you know, once you're past the certification issues. I don't know that that particular claim that you're talking about, Ben, is going to be the strongest here. I do think, though, that there might be something to the warrant of merchantability claims. And that's basically when a manufacturer or a retailer is selling an item or a product for a particular purpose, and that item basically doesn't meet the purpose that it's been sold for. Now, there are a number of nuances.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. You're confusing merchantability with warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, and both of them are claimed, but there are subtle differences between them. So merchantability just means that it's useful for what it is, which is a phone. Fitness for a particular purpose means that there's been some sort of representation that it is particularly good for X, Y, or Z. You know, in this case, Apple made a specific claim that this has better reception. So that could fit into the particular purpose. Meanwhile, merchantability would mean whether or not it functions particularly as a phone. I just wanted to clear that up. Back to you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I do. You're absolutely correct, first of all. So thanks for clarifying. I still think that whether or not you're claiming for, you know, some sort of warranty for a particular purpose or for merchantability or merchantability, however you pronounce it, you might still have a colorable claim here because, you know, if you think about the abstract question of whether or not this actually functions as a phone, maybe to those unfortunate left-handed people, they feel that it does not because the phone has a tendency to lose its signal when you grip the phone in a particular way, and those left-handed people have a tendency when they're holding the phone to their ear to, you know, put their finger in the spot that's bridging the connection between the two separate antennas. Now, I guess on the other, when you want to argue the devil's advocate point for this, it, as Steve Jobs has apparently come out in email, and I don't know whether or not this was actually him emailing or whether these were totally bogus emails, that's a separate issue. He has said that there is no reception issue. And as we've seen a number of blog posts and where we have some engineers that sort of opine on the issue, this is something that affects all cellular phones. It just seems to affect the iPhone 4 iPhone 4 disproportionately compared to other phones. So in that sense, you know, that seems to hurt the fact, just the fact that this happens to all other phones, it seems to go against any claims that you might have for either a particular fitness or for merchantability.
So on the whole?
Well, it's always difficult to speculate, and I think we'll just have to see whether or not Apple was truly aware of this issue before the phone was sold, or whether this is sort of like an after-the-fact design flaw that surfaced. It's difficult to say, but you know, the phone does still seem to function regardless of. There's some functionality left in the phone, and it's just when you bridge this connection that seems to cause the drop in calls. That really hurts the claims the most, I think. And I don't know that you can really get even a claim for unfair trade practices, like if you were false marketing the phone, or if you had company representatives coming out and saying that there isn't an issue. You know, if what surfaces factually is that they were not aware of this at the time when it was sold and that they're working diligently on the back end to try to fix this, you know, I think that really hurts the plaintiff's chances here in a successful lawsuit. But we're talking about something that is at least, a year down the line, probably 6 months before you even get, 3 to 6 months, I guess, before you get to the discovery phase where emails will actually surface in the course of the litigation. So we might not know for a while, but I'm going to venture a guess here that it will come down to the specifics of what Apple really was aware of when they first started selling the phone.
Yeah, the first thing that I'd like to point out is that if this, so this isn't solely a problem with left-handed people, but it's been publicized that way, and I wouldn't be surprised if Apple points out that, left-handed people are more prone to this than others. Then you have to wonder if the proper class is all left-handed people who bought the iPhone 4 or not, all people who bought the iPhone 4. The second thing is Apple has come out recently and said that some of the, and I don't remember if the emails that we were talking about fall into it specifically, but it's whether or not some of the recent emails that are attributed to Steve Jobs are fake. So it may not be, the things that Steve Jobs may have said about, this isn't a problem, just hold it differently, some of those emails may have been faked.
And finally, on a more cynical sort of note, class action lawsuits tend to be particularly favorable for the law firm bringing the class action lawsuit, in that they get it's going to be a percentage basis, and they'll get maybe, I don't know what the percentage might be, but they'll get a percentage, and then the entirety members of the class will get the vast majority of the percentage, except for a split through all the members of your class. I don't know if you've ever gotten anything in the mail like, you've been awarded $3 in a class action settlement. With large members in the class, there's just not going to be that much that's going to be, $5 to every iPhone 4 owner? Yay.
Well, you're talking about whether or not if this case does go forward and it's successful on the merits, and then some damages are awarded to the plaintiff's class.
Yes.
So...
But in the fact that, the attorneys will get a good percentage of the final settlement, it makes it worth their while to at least try.
That's a good point. These law firms that do these things sometimes, and you can't paint them all with this brush, but, they're looking at an opportunity to make some money, and that's usually the case with a lot of different lawsuits, whether they're filed for singular plaintiffs on a contingency fee basis, or as a class like this, but that's all sort of separate, I guess, from the issue on the merits. So I guess one last question I have. I don't know if this was an official Apple statement, so maybe you two guys, since you're Apple guys, can clarify this for me, but I believe there was at least a couple stories that came out this week that said this is not a hardware issue, this is a software issue. This is a problem with the algorithm that's used when they display the number of bars that correspond to the signal strength that you're getting on the phone. And it had sounded like, from at least one of the stories that I had read, that this was something that was going to be patched in the future. And I guess what it boils down to is the fact that when your iPhone 4, and I think this even affected previous generations of the phone, when those phones were displaying the 5 bars, you weren't actually getting 5 bars of reception. It was more like 3 or 4. And yes, this little antenna issue in the Generation 4 phone can be reproduced, but it might not be quite as severe as the little indicator with the bars on the phone, the phone software actually are displaying. Do you guys think that this might affect any of these suits at all?
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to chime in first and say that this was an official Apple statement. It was released through Apple PR, and I believe their language was, we were stunned to find that there was a problem in the way we calculated signal bars. So it's your turn, Dominic.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's an official statement, but also I'm not sure how much the problem might... in OS 2.1, or iOS 2.1, improved signal 3G signal accuracy was one of the upgrades that came out with that version. So,
and in truth, I think at least one review site has been able to, instead of using the bar indicators on the phone software, they've actually been able to patch into the hardware and read the signal, the antenna attenuation, and they do say that the iPhone Generation 4 is actually doing much better in terms of signal reception overall when you're not bridging these two antennas together. So in that sense, the phone is performing better as it was marketed in contrast to the previous generations of the phone. Just not when you bridge the antennas, apparently.
Any last thoughts before we move on to the last story, guys?
Also?
Nope. And I'm glad I waited not to buy an iPhone.
Let's be honest. Were you ever going to buy an iPhone, O'Brien?
Yeah, probably not. I'm more of an Android supporter, if anything. Even though I don't own an Android phone, I'm still stuck on BlackBerry. But that's an entirely different issue. So I guess this is the point where we should segue into our third story. And this one involves Dell, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show. And this lawsuit is actually pretty old, as I understand it. The University of Texas is suing Dell for basically providing them with computers under a contract that did not function as they intended. And I think at least some of these computers were being used in one of the sciences departments, and they were being used to run mathematical computations on them. After some period of time, the computers basically stopped working or showed signs of instability, and it eventually came out that the problem that these computers were actually experiencing was a capacitor problem. This is something that's a little near and dear to my heart, because capacitor plague is something that affected a large number of electronics between the years of around 2004 to probably 2006. I, for one, bought a couple of nice monitors from a well-respected manufacturer which had these faulty capacitors in them. And the story goes, and I don't know what's actually true or not, there was some companies that were located in the Far East, and they had supposedly stolen the trade secret formula of capacitor designs that some well-known company had used, but they apparently stole the incorrect formula, but they used this formula to create capacitors, and then they sold them for a very small amount. And a lot of the computer manufacturers, the big ones, like Dell was one that was notable. I mean, almost every company out there, I think even Apple had sold computers with these bad capacitors. They were selling the hardware like this with these bad capacitors, and they probably did this just to save money. But what ended up happening about a year or two after use is that the capacitors would start to bulge with a little bit of hydrogen inside them, and capacitors, that just not the non-solid-state ones at least, have a little bit of liquid inside them, and a chemical reaction occurred, and the tops of the capacitors would start to bulge, and in some cases burst. Some people even claimed that they would explode. The net result, though, is that the hardware stopped working. And you can actually go in, by the way, just a quick note, and fix these yourself. It's not very difficult to do, and there are a lot of websites that will show you how to do it. But when you're a university like the University of Texas, and you buy these computers for a particular purpose, a large number of them, and they don't function as intended, you're likely to be a little bit upset. And so now we're 2 or 3 years out from when the lawsuit was actually filed, and some court documents have surfaced that not only was the capacitor problem, does that seem to be the root of the problem, but also the Dell employees had some sort of awareness that this was the problem and continued to sell the computers with these faulty capacitors in them. So this is actually pretty close to what we discussed in the iPhone story here. A lot of implied warranties perhaps at issue. Do you guys have any initial thoughts on the story?
The first thing that I'd like to chime in and say is that the more damaging part of this was that Dell not only knew of this capacitor problem, but apparently instructed its employees to play dumb about the capacitor problem and tried to avoid giving service to the customers based on a known problem.
Yeah, the point I was going to make is the original reason they said that the computer stopped working is because the University of Texas had overtaxed the machines by making them perform difficult math calculations, and this was why the computers were all not working.
That one really cracked me up, because, I mean, the way that most computers are designed is that the hardware should be able to sustain large computations at maximum load for extended periods of time. The issues that you usually get when you run a computer at full load is that a lot of heat is generated, and as we all know, heat can destroy electronics quite easily, but it just seems so far-fetched that that would actually be the problem, and why would you ever sell a device ever that would have that that problem if it was run at full load for an extended period of time, that it would suddenly fail.
Yeah, and there you would have a great claim for breach of warranty for fitness for a particular purpose, because they were sold to the University of Texas math department for the purpose of doing large math calculations, and there's, you know, Dell had all of the knowledge necessary to know whether or not these computers would have been appropriate for that kind of computation. And you know, there's a rock-solid claim for breach of warranty for a particular purpose. They were purchased. Dell said, these are fit for large math computations, and then Dell, you know, blames their failure on large math computations.
So something that I read in one of these stories is that to sort of combat this after the fact, they did extend some of the warranties to include service on these computers. Would that affect the lawsuit at all?
It might mitigate the damages that they're eventually have to pay out, but it won't change the fault, especially for the initial, I hesitate to use the word, cover-up of the problem.
Right, so where someone would usually have a claim of damages for replacement cost of the computer or, you know, cost to fix the computer, if they were then covered under warranty and Dell did these did the repairs for free, they'd only be able to recover, you know, however much usefulness they lost while they were at Dell getting repaired, not the actual cost of repair anymore.
This seems to be a pretty open and shut case, but it's kind of interesting that the lawsuit still appears to be going on. According to the New York Times article, which tipped us off to this lawsuit, I think Dell had set aside a large number of money, and perhaps even in the hundreds of millions of dollar range, to settle suits related to these types of claims. So at least to me, it's a little funny that the suit still seems to be going on as court documents still seem to be popping up that show some measure of culpability.
Yeah, I saw the number of $100 million that Dell put aside $100 million to fight the lawsuit.
So I guess the next quick point that's worth discussing is contracts. When you're a university, it's usually common practice to have a contract down in place when you're going to buy a large number of computers. And in those contracts, which could either be very simple documents, like a single page, or it could be much more complex, like 30 pages, you usually have a section on warranties. And warranties are basically promises that the contracting parties are making between each other. And usually it has to do with the party that's actually selling the products. Now, in our last story, we talked a lot about these covenants of merchantability or use of a product for a particular purpose or whether it was fit for a particular purpose. It is possible in some jurisdictions to basically disclaim those warranties, even though that the law tends to recognize them by default. So I guess it's worth noting that this might boil down to what the actual contract said between the University of Texas and Dell, and you know, what exactly the warranty section had laid out in terms of what Dell was willing to cover and what they're promising that the machines were capable of doing.
A quick sort of procedural question. Do we know why these documents were unsealed now, 3 years after the case started?
I didn't see anything in the story about that.
Well, it looks like that they were sealed under a protective order. It's not really clear why it was that there was a protective order, but my guess would be that Dell has an interest in keeping like pretty damaging documents like this sealed for an extended period of time so that it doesn't hurt, you know. I mean, you have to remember they're a publicly traded company, so if something like this were to surface, and it would surface without the ability for Dell to sort of come out and say things, at least directly beyond, because they might not want to talk about stuff that's related to the lawsuit. So you sort of minimize the impact, I guess, of these sort of documents when they surface if you can get a protective order. But I'm not entirely familiar with protective orders that relate to documents in the course of litigation. And, you know, there are almost always, like, procedural nuances of what you need to satisfy if you're claiming that documents should be protected under some sort of sealed order prior to when the court says, yeah, we're going to seal these for, you know, a set period of time. Do you guys have any other thoughts on the story?
I'm all set.
All set. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty open and shut case.
Yeah, I guess as a tip from the Technically Legal crew, it you should always watch out, I guess, for electronic products that were manufactured in this time period. There's a pretty long Wikipedia page on capacitor plague, and like I said, there's a lot of websites that cover capacitor plague, but it seems to have affected hardware in between the time period of around 2004, and I think I just saw 2007, early 2007. So you should always be skeptical whenever you're looking to purchase used computer equipment from that time period. And with that, thanks again for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. My name is David O'Brien, and with me were
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff.
Please send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Visit our website at technicallylegal.org to read the blog, or follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. We'll see you next week.